You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Space Force! Space Force. Who couldn't be against Space Force? I was looking at Mike Pence's speech today, laying out a small amount of additional fear and stuff like that to get us to go, yes, Space Force. Reminds me of, you know, when my childhood. Look, you know, the space, the final frontier. When I was a kid, all in. Cute little uniform would have been fantastic. all the little toys and the gadgets. As a kid, my favorite TV show was Lost in Space, which, you know, maybe we could put Pence and Trump on a rocket or a spaceship, send them out and, you know, maybe watch the hijinks from here, a safe distance away. My favorite magazine was Omni magazine. I loved all the Ray Bradbury, all the Johnny Rocket, all of that stuff. Living it, Space Force. And I gotta wonder if this is one of those things that, you know, maybe when Trump and Pence were little kids, they were thinking the same things. So this is just, you know, their childhood come to reality, come to life. Yes, Space Force. Now, I don't know that it's actually going to happen. I know we had talked about just the other day that the Chinese have increased their hypersonic, you know, travel, which I got to think that we're still ahead of them. We're just not advertising it. But this is a nice way. And I said it, you know, the other day when we talked with Luke Vargas, this is a nice way of going, you know what? We don't need guns or we don't need butter or milk or sugar or shoes. We need guns. We need spaceships. We need toys. And it got me thinking about Eisenhower today in his Chance for Peace speech. You know, again, you know, missed opportunities. And the famous quote of his that every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, from those who are cold and not clothed. He said, this world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, and the hopes of its children. He says, the cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. And it's two fine, fully equipped hospitals. Now, inflation, way out. I mean, you know, to a modern bomber today, we could get a lot more than that. But he goes on to say it's also some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all. in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. And we are starting the next arms race. I mean, this is really what this was today, was that shot across the bow, if you will. This is us saying, yep, game on. We're going to, any of those social programs that you socialist people wanted, like, education for your kids, like any debt forgiveness for you college kids who are, a generation in debt. Any help of, making sure that seniors retire with dignity and have health, that stuff all gone. We are now all in for the final frontier, the space war. It's going to be Buck Rogers in the 25th century, which oddly enough, I just, not too long ago, ordered the discs online, and my kids, we sit and we watch Buck Rogers. It's like, I think it came out in the late 70s, early 80s, and still entertaining and fun and, well, our future. So, not only were they creating very entertaining television with Aaron Gray in very tight spandex outfits, very attractive, which, again, caught my attention. We're now, this is how we're doing public policy. Yeah, good stuff. Space Force, all the cute little toys and the gadgets, and today I spent a little time indulging myself to remember back when I was 8 or 9 years old, going, wouldn't it be great if we could have little things to beam us around, or we could talk to people on the phone and see them, and well, we actually have that now, or the laser guns or the chariot or any of that stuff. I'm like, fabulous. Now we do have some of the aluminum foil blankets like they used on the Jupiter one. We're just now giving them to kids that we stole from their parents and are making them sleep on concrete floors in 50 degree air conditioned rooms. Yeah, that we're doing that. I don't think that's what they really thought those blankets for. But I started thinking about the jetpack. Anybody else remember Lost in Space? They had these cool jetpacks that you could, you just put the button and it would just shoot you like a rocket all around. You could fly all around the place. I'm excited about the possibilities of all the toys that can be marketed to our kids. I mean, because I have this conversation with a friend, fairly often, because he likes to point out that my generation, my age group, we were really the last generation to grow up in a kind of a normal way. Where we got to go out and play, and we weren't constantly inundated with, advertisers trying to get our attention, that we could be kids, that you go out, ride your bikes, and you're with your friends, and there wasn't all this electronic gadgetry and all this stuff to get your attention and all that. And also, the merchandising. Because I remember as a kid going, boy, wouldn't it be great if Lost in Space had all these toys? And they didn't. But today, can you imagine the profit margins of the companies who come out with these gadgets for Space Force? Cute little space. You could have the new generation of brown shirts, only we could call them Space Force. It would be great. Screw the Boy Scouts. We got Space Force. This would be phenomenal. Think of the possibilities. And this has got to be kind of what they're thinking. This whole new branch of the military. Start from scratch, our legacy, and cute little uniforms. Because evidently, that's one of the things that they're battering around. Because they haven't had to come up with a new uniform for our military since 1947. Evidently, the last year that we fired up a new branch, which was the Air Force. So yeah, good stuff. Mike Pence said, it's a new chapter. The next great chapter in our history of armed forces. We're going to be prepared for the battlefield of the next generation, where the best and the bravest will be called to deter and defeat a new generation of threats. It's almost like JFK. It's that kind of flag waving. You're gonna be able to fly in spaceships and fight like Buck Rogers. It's gonna be just like Star Wars. The Force will be with you. Now, here's the thing. The reality is they're right on a certain level. We are being cyber attacked like crazy. And for me, a big part of this is I think we have too much dependence on electronics. I think we have too much dependence on what we can put out into space. My problem becomes, if you've read any articles on what's going on in space, there's so much junk in space that I think the first thing we should do globally is, I don't know, start a space garbage company. You know, like have a space garbage truck to go clean up all of the crap that we've been shooting into space over the last couple of generations. In fact, the article that I was reading was said that a lot of the satellites, when they go down, it's because they're crashing into each other. Because there's so much junk. And now we're just going to have a patrol. We're going to have Space Force. So I would love to hear people's thoughts on this. Do we need a Space Force? Is this the future of armed conflict in the world? Is this what we need to have? Do we absolutely need to be pursuing Space Force, or is this just going to go nowhere? It's nice conversation. It's fun talk. You can mock it or you can go, yes, we need it. And the chances of it getting through Congress probably slim and none. I'm thinking not going anywhere, but interesting to battle that around. And you know, the thing is, I was thinking about Eisenhower and, you know, a decent Republican. When was the last time we had one of those? When we had done our labor history tour back in 2013, we went to Eisenhower's house. His presidential library is in the same place where his childhood home was. Independence, Kansas is where Truman's was. But it was Eisenhower's, you know, family home was in Kansas. And, you know, you walked through this very meager home and this library that was filled with, you know, all of these calls to higher, callings. You know, the idea that, you know, we should not be spending all this money on guns and bombs. We should be making humanity better. Where is that person? Where's that person today? And I'm often curious, you know, what he would think of Space Force. As a military guy, because look, you know, we heard some of the early reports from like Jim Mattis, who I guess was on board with it, but didn't want to set up a whole different bureaucracy. Because look, you do need to make sure that you keep up with technology. I mean, the one thing that you can say about this country is that we've always pushed the bounds of technology, the bounds of possible. And, you know, my fear has been over the last 20, 30 years that maybe we haven't been doing that. And because what we've done, instead of investing in the next generation of technology and pushing the bounds of technology, we've given the resource away. Big tax cuts for the very wealthy, running huge deficits and all of that stuff. Is this one of those moments where we start to catch up? Because understand, you know, the space race, which was, you know, lots of money, was phenomenal. For investment, it was phenomenal for job creation. It was phenomenal for for the future of this country and all the things that we got out of it. Hey, we got Tang. Who could not be thrilled with the idea that the space race got us Tang, that yummy orange drink with water? But no, we got tons of stuff. I mean, I took a train ride with a guy at Disney, oddly enough, who worked for NASA. And he went through all of the things that NASA had brought us, you know, microwaves and, you know, just this whole list. And he was just going off about, you know, all, you know, Velcro and all the things that we take for granted every day came out of the investment that government had made in the space race. And it was all done by private companies, and it was all public-private partnerships, and all of this stuff. And you know, he was really making the case not to privatize NASA, which I think is a bad idea. And it makes me wonder: will we privatize Space Force? You know, will this now be a for-profit military venture? Lots of questions here. Lots of questions, lots of thoughts. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Quick break. We're going to be back with Sarah Kendzior. We're going to talk about the Gates trial, maybe what's going on in Kansas, some thoughts on Missouri. Lots and lots to talk about. Quick break. Right back with Sarah. Stick around.
Own 90% of the wealth, 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day 53 construction tradesmen were killed in a fire at the Titan II ICBM launch complex near Searcy, Arkansas. It is considered one of the worst industrial accidents at a U.S. nuclear weapons facility. The complex was one of four sites containing Titan II missiles. Each missile weighed 340,000 pounds, measuring 103 feet in length and 10 feet in diameter. President Johnson had just committed more troops to the Vietnam War. The Air Force had hoped to strengthen the silo against a possible Soviet attack. They had contracted with Peter Kiewit and Son of Colorado to bring in electricians, carpenters, millwrights, painters, and pipe fitters for a number of tasks. Crews worked to shore up the silo, improve the blast doors, adjust hydraulics, and install emergency lighting. 52 of the 55 workers on all nine levels of the silo were almost immediately asphyxiated when it suddenly filled with smoke and heat. The Air Force determined a welder on level 2 had accidentally pierced a high-pressure hydraulic line, igniting the fire. Investigators also concluded that the silo lacked adequate ventilation, alternative exits, and independent power sources. The contractor was held responsible for numerous safety violations, contributing to unsafe work conditions. The welder was found drowned in hydraulic fluid. Two survivors suffered burns and smoke inhalation. They contested the Air Force's findings. One worker insisted no one had been welding on level 2. The other survivor stated he saw flames burst from the diesel engine just before the power went out. Both men insisted the fire started from below. By 1981, two more deadly accidents involving Titan II missiles would prompt President Reagan to order their deactivation.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come crumbling, crumbling. The walls come tumbling, crumbling down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So Space Force, my favorite comment so far on the do we need Space Force is, will the aliens and Martians be the ones paying for Space Force? Very good question. I guess we've got as good a chance of the aliens and Martians paying for Space Force as we do of the Mexicans paying for the wall. So, just throw it into the wish and hope category, or at least into the hand where you're wishing, because the other one will fill up full of, is what it is. But there you go, Space Force. Cannot wait for Space Force. Anyway, lots going on. The Gates trial, the Manafort trial. Gates wrapped up his testimony. Here to talk a little bit about what's going on all around that with the guy with the ostrich coat and the satin panties. I've asked our good friend Sarah Kendzior to come back and share some thoughts. Writer, journalist, and also the co-host of a great, fabulous podcast, Gaslit Nation. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, let's start with Space Force. Are you excited? Space Force!
Oh, God. I feel like, you know, I get stupider as I even try to discuss this. I mean, I've got nothing to say. You know, I just kind of look at all of the problems that we've been discussing for decades. You know, like, how do you fund health care? How do you fund school? I mean, it's a rote commentary of, like, obviously, if you have the money for a goddamn Space Force, you can pay for basic things. But You know, and of course, that's not what they're choosing to do. And I think that there's probably a bit more to it than that, given the way that they move money through various kind of schemes and operations in order to cover up corruption. And I have a feeling it has to go along with that. But Jesus yeah. Christ.
From our pocket yeah. to theirs, most certainly. But, you know, the thing is they've been kind of laying the groundwork here, because the Chinese now have this, you know, this subsonic aircraft that they just, you know, just claimed the other day, you know, they're far ahead of us and we got to catch up. So it's the next way to rob us blind and to not make us ask for things.
Yeah, it's robbing us blind. And, you know, the other thing I do worry about, because it is Trump and it's Russia and, you know, Trump works against American interests, is, you know, who will control satellites, whether this is a way to stage some sort of attack. You know, it's a very, I think, unusual situation that we have a president who seems completely willing and sometimes enthusiastic to attack our institutions and possibly our own citizens, to bring the country down, to strip it down for parts. I mean, that's what they've been steadily doing in other capacities. This would be rather dramatic. I didn't necessarily expect this strategy to extend to outer space, but this is Trump. You know, I'm sort of curious what Gingrich, his friend, you know, has to say on this with his moon colony obsession and whatnot. And oh my God, I swear to God, seriously, I'm getting stupider as we're talking about this. Like, I can feel it. So
we're,
I don't know.
We're literally going further down the rabbit hole, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, I listen to myself and I'm just like, you know, build something else that's like a sci-fi thing. Build like a time machine so I can like get out of this conversation and travel back to like a normal one. But anyway.
All right. So good. Well, then since this has taken us down, let's get to the Manafort trial. Anything surprising in this? I'll tell you the one thing that surprised me. The fact that, you know, because we've been told, we've been led to believe that Manafort is this kind of thug. There are allegations that he's had people killed, all of this stuff. And to find out that Rick Gates was actually stealing from him was quite comical to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think Manafort is a thug. Manafort is a murderer. Manafort is a scumbag. And one who's, you know, experienced and good at it. It doesn't mean that he's going to be on the ball with everything. And I think that they have a different sort of sense of money. You know, it's not about making money in terms of having, you know, wealth that you can inherit and pass down through generations and invest in a sort of traditional thing. It's about having leverage. It's about having power. You know, both Trump and Manafort were groomed by Roy Cohn, you know, as I've mentioned many times in the show, whose dream in life, which he fulfilled, was to die in massive debt to the government and to get away with all of these great financial fraud schemes, to sort of just pull one over on people and not get caught. You know, Manafort, of course, got caught, but I'm not surprised that he also sort of, in certain ways, got screwed over in the process, went into debt in the process. You know, but I think it's sort of, you have to view how they, you know, how they work with finances differently. And yeah, it was also interesting to see the clothing selection and the fact that that jacket makes him look like a geriatric member of New Kids on the Block. But that said, yeah, interesting trial.
Now, if he wore that with the silk trousers, that would be you kind of look like a 1970s pimp then.
Oh, God, man, you know, real sexy. It's like, you know, we've suffered enough as a nation. Like, I didn't need to see all that. Like, I've been through too much. You know what I mean? There's a limit for me, and I think I've hit it. But, yeah.
But at some point, you need the comedy. I mean, at some point, you need to laugh. And look, you know, Space Force today for me was that laugh. I needed to go, you know what? Now we've jumped the shark.
You ask me about Space Force, I, like, lose my shit on the show. I have to stop talking about it. It's just like, where are we going with this? Anyway, yeah, Space Force.
No, I mean, for me, it was kind of like, now we've officially jumped the shark. I mean, now.
Well, you know, you have these moments where you're just like, you know, President Donald Trump, secret Kremlin asset, has now created a space force. And you're just like, you know, this is like a Mad Lib constructed by like a drug-addled 6-year-old in like 1991. Like, you're just like, what's going on? I mean, and I'm someone, of course, you know, somewhat knows what's going on. That's why I'm on your show. You know, I follow this on a day-to-day level, and every now and again, there's just something that hits me, and I can't quite, you know, grasp that this is an ongoing reality that, you know, my children will have to contend with, and my grandchildren, if there is, you know, an Earth to inhabit. We're not, you know, living out, I guess, in Space Force territory. So, yeah, interesting time.
Yeah, big fun. And, you know, the thing that's interesting to me is, you know, I'm watching this Manafort trial, and you know, it's kind of boring, to be honest. It's accountants and it's, you know, it's math, and it's basically just tax evasion, which, look, we knew.
Yeah, I mean, this particular trial, you know, is oriented toward that. And I think Gates' testimony is, you know, going to be oriented toward that because of the nature of the charges. I'll be surprised if this is the limit of the charges brought against Manafort, both by Mueller and probably charges at the state level. And I think that we're going to be looking at something well beyond financial crimes. You know, he has been tried for, I mean, he has been indicted for conspiracy against the United States. I think we're going to be seeing a lot more that's directly involving the 2016 campaign. You know, those ties are already being built, you know, to the public, even though these charges are, you know, on a somewhat related but distinct manner. I think that they're trying to kind of build this case. I mean, it's blindingly obvious to anybody who's, like, followed the news about Manafort or knows, you know, the most basic stuff about his life, that these two things, you know, his mafia ties, his financial dealings, his debt, his relationship with oligarchs, and Trump's campaign and his role as Trump's voluntary campaign manager, you know, are obviously connected and should, you know, bring down Trump. I mean, when you have everyone in Trump's inner circle either getting indicted or under suspicion, and of course today we had an associate of Roger Stone's served apparently with a subpoena from Mueller. It's Randy Credico, had previously been served with a subpoena from the House Committee, and it fled the Fifth. He's now back in there. They're going into the, some characters from the Elliot Spitzer saga that were also involved with Stone. You know, Kristen Davis, the madam from New York, she's being subpoenaed. And all these people are coming in, so it's kind of obvious what Mueller's doing. You know, and the scope is very wide. The evidence is vast, and it seems to be a very multifaceted, layered crime circle. But as I've said repeatedly, I'm not sure we have the time to really, you know, investigate this to the degree without enormous damage taking place at the federal level at the same time. So, because all this is going on, we still have kids who are separated from their parents. We have them doing things like passing laws that want to bring asbestos back. I mean, it's just like anything that can hurt the ordinary American citizen, they are doing, and they're pursuing it with such aggression and such speed, and that speed is not matched by the Mueller team. And you can kind of argue, okay, that's not Mueller's job, but I feel like it's kind of his duty. It's kind of his obligation, because if you have common sense, you know, you're going to see how many people are going to be hurt if this doesn't move along a little bit faster, because the damage done already is just incalculable.
Is it possible this is all designed solely to flip Manafort so that all that stuff can happen? Because, you know, there's part of me that goes, look, if he does go away for these charges, it's going to be for a very long time. And I don't see him as a guy who's willing to fall on the sword, which is why I remember the tweet that Trump put out, you know, comparing the treatment of Manafort to Alphonse Capone, which I don't think I've ever heard him referred to as Alphonse.
I don't think Trump wrote that tweet at all. And I'm kind of curious who did, because, yeah, he would never say Alphonse Capone. I mean, he would say Al Capone. And I felt like, you know, someone was trying to send a message with that tweet, you know, perhaps to Manafort's legal team. I don't know. I thought it was a strange one, even by the Trump, you know, kind of ghostwriter tweet standards. You know, every now and again, it's very obvious when someone else is writing the tweets. Either they're doing something gracious and generous of human spirit, which obviously is not Trump, or they're writing weird-ass shit about, you know, great cities of Moscow and these kind of poetic grand terms that I also think are not Trump, and I also think are messages of some kind, you know, and that those tweets still bear reexamination. But Yeah, I mean, in terms of Manafort, I still don't think he'll flip. I've never thought he was going to flip. I don't think it's necessary for him to flip because there's so much evidence. And, you know, among the most striking evidence is that which Trump himself has put into the public domain by repeatedly confessing to his own crimes.
Right.
You know, he's confessed to obstruction of justice. He's confessed to collusion, or just said, you know, it's cool to collude with the Russians. Yes, I met with the Russians. And he lied about that originally. He said it was about adoption. Now he's saying, yeah, we were trying to get dirt on Clinton from a hostile foreign state. And, you know, and from there you can go into emoluments, you can go into all kinds of things. With Kushner, you can get him out just by virtue of his security clearance lies alone. And those are the most dangerous people. I mean, those are the ones that I'm kind of concentrating on. Trump, Kushner, Sessions. Pence is dirty too and dangerous and needs to be out. He's a little bit of a tougher target, although we should always remember, as the Manafort trial keeps going, that Manafort selected Pence. He was very invested in getting Pence in there, and so I think it would be worth looking into why exactly that was.
Good point. You brought up the Trump meeting. Now we find out that there was potentially a second meeting before, or a first meeting before the first meeting. Any thoughts on that?
God, maybe I haven't heard about this. I've been like...
There was evidently, reportedly, they're saying that there was a meeting before the June 9th, the Trump Tower meeting with the Russian lawyer. Evidently, there was a meeting before that, 2 days before.
That would make sense given, some of the comments that Donald Trump Jr. made in the emails, where he certainly didn't sound surprised by any of this, so I'd have to relook at the dates of those emails. I mean, I feel like the idea that this has not been in the works for years is kind of false. That, like, one day in 2016, like, you know, Kremlin people and oligarchs, these are people, of course, have known Trump and Manafort and Stone personally for decades, suddenly came out and said, you know, hey, you guys, we can help. I do not think it was this sort of random thing that started to happen in 2016. I think perhaps the investigation maybe picked up. Russian mafia activity and its relationship to the Trump campaign at around that time. I mean, when you hire Paul Manafort as your campaign manager, that's what happens. But I think these ties go back a long time. We know that, for example, Felix Sater and Michael Cohen were emailing each other back in 2015 saying, you know, they were going to get Trump in office and Russia was going to help. And it's like, you know, there are lots of statements like that. There's Trump's own interview in 2014 where he said Russia is going to help with something and, you know, we're not going to object to it. And, you know, he obviously was thinking of a presidential run at that point. He had just run before in 2012. He's repeatedly run. And so, you know, the idea of them having other meetings, like, yeah, I definitely think they had other meetings. I just don't think that they began in 2016. I think a number of different individuals had been meeting for a long time. I mean, other examples, of course, are the RT Gala that was held in December of 2015, you know, which Jill Stein went to, Michael Flynn went to. At the same time, Sheriff Clark was over in Russia in that same month in December 2015. We had the NRA's involvement going back there. So, you know, these guys were all talking to each other. And so another meeting in Trump Tower, I just see it as like one more item on a very long list.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are saying that maybe the plan was hatched even as far back as 2013 when Trump was in Moscow for the Miss Universe pageant.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the plan as a sort of, you know, an ideal, something that they'd ultimately want to achieve, both Trump getting into power, Manafort and his Russian oligarch mafia connections wanting to benefit from this arrangement, U.S. plutocrats wanting to benefit from it, that was always kind of around, and I think they were waiting in some sense for the right conditions. You know, Trump did run in 2012. I think they realized he wasn't going to win then. And I think you had a perfect storm brought about by 2016. And part of that was a storm they created through the manipulation of social media, both in terms of hacking, you know, voter databases, but also these propaganda campaigns and, you know, the weaponization of networks and technology that just didn't exist in 2012. Like in 2012, we weren't all walking around with smartphones in our pockets. People weren't on Facebook en masse. And when you have people locked in this technology, locked in these social media monopolies, it becomes easier to wage the kind of, you know, warfare that they did. And you also had a real deterioration of social and economic conditions during this time that, you know, was not caused by Russia. That was just happening within the United States, which they capitalized on. So I think they had a very, you know, ripe conditions to hatch this plot. I also think that had Hillary won and gotten into office, we'd be in the middle of impeachment hearings for her on baseless charges. We'd be in the middle of, you know, a zillion Charlottesville-like events. I don't think it would have gone smoothly because I think they really were very determined to do this. It was just a matter of which way, you know, they managed to achieve it.
No, I'm right there with you. I wanted to get your thoughts before I let you go on the Nunes tapes, on what's going on there.
Oh, God. I mean, with Nunes, it's really amazing to me that we've known how dirty Nunes was for such a long time. You know, back in March 2017 was when he had that kind of, you know, frantic, worried press conference where it looked like he was worried he would be held accountable for his complicity, you know, for the fact that he was acting as a lapdog instead of a watchdog in terms of oversight. And he's just there. You know, he's like another example of, you know, the audacity of, you know, the criminal, you know, flagrancy of how Trump and his lackeys behave. You know, I had some hope he might be removed from that committee or investigated in his own right, and he's just there wielding power over it. And you see this attitude, you know, all throughout the Republican Party. You see it with Kobach in Kansas. You know, you see it in other Republicans who basically want to control the law in order to break the law. You know, that's the goal. And they're not hiding that that's the goal anymore. I think that's why they've been relatively unconcerned about winning the midterms. That's their attitude, their very cavalier, relaxed attitude toward that has alarmed me for a long time. So that's a pattern people need to watch out for. I think they, you know, people had this idea that, like, oh, the Republicans wouldn't do it so brazenly. You know, they're afraid that you'll notice. They're afraid they'll get caught. It's like, no, they're only afraid they'll get punished. They're not afraid of being caught anymore. They're not afraid of letting you know that this is not a democracy, or they don't want it to be a democracy anymore, that they openly want a one-party state through corruption that we can witness with our own eyes. And they don't care because they just don't care about the public's opinion. And that's not how America is supposed to work.
No, I would argue we're already there. I mean, they've already been caught, and we're not punishing them. That's the problem.
Oh, God, yes, that's the problem. It drives me absolutely nuts. And that's, you know, and I know there's like a limited capacity for how they can be punished. You know, the Democrats don't have a majority. There's only so much they could do, although I still think they could be much more vocal about a lot of this. You know, some of them are, some of them aren't. But, you know, in terms of people who can indict these crimes, it's like you've got to do it quicker. You know, you've got to do it sooner, because the longer this goes on, you know, as you and I both been saying for a long time, the more entrenched it gets and the harder it is to get them out. You know, you have to undo the damage that they did, but also people start to shift their expectations of law, you know, of consequence, of repercussions. It starts to seem to people like, oh, this is just the way things are. And I've seen this in authoritarian states. You know, most of the states that I studied when I was studying the former Soviet Union had this attitude about corruption. It wasn't like people liked corruption. They absolutely hated it. You know, it was misery for them to live in that kind of state, but they also expected it. And so they were much less likely to kind of challenge it, you know, on a small scale, whether it's like, you know, an officer asking for a bribe, or on a large scale, like your president, you know, being your only president in history and constantly extending his term under illegal conditions. And it's so demoralizing. And so I really wish, you know, since we do have a legal system still that can indict these people and get them out and show that there are consequences for these behavior, that they would use the tools they have before they don't have those tools anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the examples I used yesterday is your state of Missouri, where yesterday, and good on the voters there, they pushed back the whole the right to work nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, here's in the two two instances where voters have been able to go to the polls and push back, at least in the last couple of years, overwhelmingly 2-1, voters have said, no, we don't want this kind of poison. Yet the Republicans continue to push it without any fear of, you know, just what you said, any fear of being held accountable at the ballot box.
Yes, and that's alarming because they should be afraid. I mean, you know, I live in Missouri, and I've yet to meet anyone, Democrat or Republican, you know, I don't know any hotshot Republican donors, so maybe that's my problem, that wanted a right to work. You know, everyone is against it. You could drive in any corner of the state and see signs against it. So this is something where you really have, you know, a unified population coming out, and I hope that Claire McCaskill takes advantage of this and, you know, highlights labor issues in her campaign, and also notes that it is Republican donors that are trying to screw over the American worker, you know, that are trying to back these kind of laws, including her opponent. You know, so I hope that that comes through. But yeah, you'd think that they would be pretty worried about that and pretty worried about all these special elections where Democrats are winning. Turnout is incredibly high. The turnout in the Missouri, you know, primary and special elections this week was just unbelievably high. You'd think they'd be a little more concerned, and they're not. No. And, you know, and that's for the reasons that I brought up before, you know, whether there will be a hacking or they'll just use the pretext of a hacking and say, oh, you know, the Democrats didn't really win. It was Russia hacking on their behalf, which is absolutely absurd. Those are all serious things that we may face down the line. And also, to plug the podcast, we're doing a special episode on election security, election integrity. It'll be the next one coming out, I think, in about 11 days. You know, we interviewed an expert on the topic. It went really well, so people should listen in for tips on what ordinary citizens can do, you know, to battle this kind of corruption.
I cannot wait for it. It's one of the things I look forward to. Sarah, keep up the great work. I appreciate the time, and I hope you'll come back again real soon and entertain us at least and inform us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks
back.
So much. Always great talking with you. Again, check out the podcast, Gaslit Nation. We'll make sure we get a link out so people can take a quick look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that young women workers at the YH Trading Company in Seoul, South Korea, staged a sit-in strike. The women made wigs for export. The company had been one of the leading exporters in the nation. But then the managers began to move the profits from the wig company to a shipping company under the same ownership, as well as to a film production company. This drained the profits from the wig factory and left it in massive debt. The owners shut down the company without warning, firing all of the employees. These women did not only lose their jobs. Water and electricity were turned off at the factory dormitories where the workers lived. A union represented the young women. The union planned a strike at the building, but the police were called in to break it up. The workers decided to move their protest to the local headquarters of the New Democratic Party. The party was in opposition to the leader of Seoul, President Park Chung-hee. The fired women were welcomed at the New Democratic Party headquarters. There, they decided to stage a sit-in to bring attention to their situation. The workers' sit-in only lasted 3 days. Then 1,000 police stormed the building. They overturned furniture and broke windows. They dragged the women out of the building violently. One woman, 21-year-old Kim Young-suk, died in the raid. She fell from the roof of the building in a clash with the police. 4 of the union leaders were sent to prison. More than 200 of the workers were expelled out of the city of Seoul and sent back home to rural areas. Today's Labor History in Two brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
So I knew it was going to happen. Today, my email box, the RNC sends me an email every day to tell me what I'm supposed to know from them. And it was all the story that we talked about yesterday where the vice chair of the DNC, Michael Blake, was on TV with a right winger, and they had asked him, "Well, what does your party stand for?" So the whole email is that the Democrats don't stand for anything, because that's the narrative. That's the only narrative that they have left. And I still think Blake's response, which was not in the email, oddly enough, of "Well, we're the party not going to jail," I thought was the perfect response. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C. Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you.
So what do you think? Party not going to jail. I think that's a perfect response.
Well, actually, Collins is in trouble within the Republican. Now, this was from the RNC?
Yeah, every day the RNC sends me a couple of emails to tell me what the talking points of the day are and what the issue of the day, what I should be focused on.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I'm not on the mailing list, but I know that I've been watching the Ohio election, Ohio 12 district here. I've been asked all day long about that across the country.
And that's a huge one because that's right in your backyard. So what's it looking like?
Well, two of the counties, Rick, Licking County and Muskingum, are counties I had when I was in Congress. Now, Licking County was shared between John Kasich and I when I first got in 1995. Then he moved on to Wall Street. Then he became governor. And then a guy replaced him named Pat Tiberi. And Pat quit, and that's what ended up with this, causing the special election. Now, this is a fascinating seat and candidates because there was a guy named Troy Balderson, and he was not the conservative favorite, but he won the primary. And Pat Tiberi, the incumbent congressman, actually gave him, I think, about $400,000 out of his own, campaign account. Yeah. And then I got this brochure mailed to me at home here, and I gave it to an attorney I know that was supporting the conservative Republican woman, against Troy Balderson. And I'm not kidding you, Rick. I howled. I've never seen a brochure like this in my lifetime. Six pages of "I'm Troy Balderson, and I'm Pat Tiberi." And then it has a picture of Pat Tiberi, the congressman that quit. And it says, "Pat Tiberi is for, stopping illegals. I'm Troy Balderson. I'm Pat Tiberi." I mean, it went on for six pages. I about died. So anyway, it was very clear that Tiberi wanted him in, and Tiberi's running the business roundtable now in Ohio. Well, along comes Danny O'Connor. Danny O'Connor is he's a decent guy and everything, but he's not a wow, Barack Obama or wow, this guy's electric. He's just not. Not bad. I'm not trying to put the guy down, Rick, but he's just not like one of those candidates you say, wow, this guy's on fire, So you got Troy Balderson and Danny O'Connor. Now, the seat has been 30 years Republican-controlled. And, again, I had two of the counties, and I would win those all the time. In fact, those were the only basic Republican counties practically in the district at that time. Well, Balderson had Trump in and Pence, and any Republican with a heartbeat was in there. And they canvassed and did this and that. He's now ahead 1,500 votes.
Yeah. They outspent O'Connor 5-1.
And today they found 588 ballots, and this is all legitimate. It's not everybody's talking about fraud. 588 ballots that weren't counted through the system. They counted them. They were in a suburb of Franklin County, Columbus, Ohio. Columbus. They were in a suburb, which is typically kind of Republican, right? Obviously, usually. And it came out to 180 or 90 votes in favor of the Democratic candidate in the suburb. So outstanding are about 3,000-some provisional ballots and overseas ballots. And you know what they tend to do. Well, if they're overseas, they'll tend to go Republican. Maybe not in this case.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Uh-huh. And my fear is that it ends up being, it gets down to under 1,000 votes, and we blame the Green Party for putting a candidate up.
Yeah, they did have a candidate. Manchik, I think was the name. But the interesting thing about this seat is it's a warning sign to the Republicans because there is no way. And again, Danny O'Connor is not a bad guy. There was no silver bullets, on Balderson, the Republican. But I've got to tell you, it should never, no matter what, have been this close.
No, that's what I've been saying all along. Because the last, obviously, that district went 11 points for Trump. But I guess from what I understand, the last election with Tiberi there, It was like a 36-point win. It was a massive win. It was just a complete blowout. Why you'd even have someone run in a district like that, and to have it be this close, should be the canary in the coal mine, if you will.
Right.
And I'm hoping, because look, as I said, the night of the election, there are probably 70 more seats across the country that were much more competitive in the last couple of elections than this one was. So Republicans, be very afraid.
And if Balderson wins, he's temporary because they have to run against each other in November again.
Right.
So this seat's still up for grabs.
Yeah, and that's what I said. I go, it's a 3-month win. Come back in the fall when there's going to be a lot more energy and the Republicans can't outspend them 5-1, and we'll see what happens.
Well, look, if Balderson wins, he's got a swearing in and he gets a photo op and everything. But here's the point. One mistake in 60 days as an incumbent, and it could cost him.
You know, like getting lost, going to the bathroom, something like that?
Something. You never know.
But, you know, you look at, you know, because these are one of these elections where, you know, people go, oh, you know, my vote doesn't count. Yeah, it does. I look at this one. I look at the governor's race in Kansas, where evidently they just found another batch of votes that has tightened that race up even more. And every vote matters. Now, I look at Kansas, which has a weird, screwy kind of scenario where one of the candidates, Kris Kobach, is actually the Secretary of State, who I guess gets to oversee the counting of the elections and sets kind of the rules and enforces the rules on how they'll be counted. I mean, just the appearance of the possibility of cheating, to me, says that he should be recusing himself.
Well, yes, he should be, and they can set up, you know, somebody or a deputy or whatever they would do in a case like that, but I thought it was strange that, you know, he wasn't going to do that.
But are we, I mean, honestly, knowing who he is, does it surprise you at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just thought there'd be so much pressure.
Yeah, evidently not on that side. I mean, if it were a Democrat, I mean, I truly believe that there would be much more pressure. Mm-hmm. It's kind of screwy. But here again, the message out of all of this is that every vote counts and make sure in November you march yourself to the polls. There you go. So, interesting news. Trump is officially accusing Russia of the chemical attack in the UK. Is that got that right?
Yes, and of course the attack occurred earlier this year and they said it was Russian a long time ago. So I think the timing of the sanctions are obviously up for suspicion. Number two, these aren't sanctions like they would do against Iran. These are, they're sanctions, but they're, you know, on some licensure, and it's not, they're not, destructive.
It's for show.
I mean, the timing of it is, you know, this has happened a while back.
And, yeah, kind of suspicious. So what was in the hand delivered letter from Trump to Putin that Rand Paul took over? Any idea?
I don't know.
I'm sorry for the. I'm sorry
thank
for the.
You. I don't know.
I'm sorry for having to do this. I need to look like I can save face. You think that's kind of what it was?
I don't know. I guess it maybe thank you.
I mean, Rand Paul is usually, you know, crazy out on the fringe. I can't imagine that he would allow himself to be used like this.
Well, you know, his father, Ron Paul, and I used to say this a lot, two of the most, very genuine people, whether you liked what they had to say or positions or what, were, you know, Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul when they were both in Congress.
Right.
And, Ron Paul, when it came to foreign affairs, he was talking about talking to Iran way long before. Now, I don't know if some of that rubbed off on Rand Paul that, you know, he doesn't, he's not afraid of sticky situations in the foreign affairs, you know, department, because they tend to not go for intervention. You know, they're anti-interventionist. But delivering the letter is kind of different.
Yeah, don't we have channels for that?
Mm-hmm.
Don't we have couriers to do that? When did a U.S. senator become a bag boy? It just kind of struck me.
It is. It's different.
It is different. Now the big news: Gates done with his testimony in the Manafort trial. What are we thinking so far?
The judge, it appears, has a bias against the government. He's been pretty tough on the government. At one point, he said, "Okay, you've made it clear that Manafort's rich," you know, and things like that. this is one of those trials that's filled with all what we call the sexy stuff, you know, that DC's made of. The, you know, the corruption, the money, the shell companies, the cheating on your wife. I mean, it had every aspect of everything. I don't know that the finish by Gates was a, you know, nuclear explosion. I don't know if it was that I would call it a fizzled firecracker. I mean, it's there, and it's damaging to Manafort, obviously, because Gates has admitted things. It was interesting. I don't know how he said this, but somebody had asked if the government had mentioned how many years he could be, you know, could have done time. They said, "Is it true that they mentioned 200 years to you?" And he answered something to the effect of, "No, no, no. It was 100, something like that." You know?
Yeah, like you'd make it out of that one.
Well, if you get 100 years, Rick, the first 90 is the toughest. The last 10 aren't. But I don't know that this trial is going. The bombshell is there to come out about, you know, Trump and the campaign and, you know, what I just don't see where it's going to enter into this trial.
Yeah, I don't think that's what this was about, though. I think this was about squeezing Manafort to face 100 years in jail. And like you said, it's those first 90. Because, look, you know, they've laid a pretty good case of him being a tax cheat. And I found it interesting that, you know, Trump said that, you know, Alphonse Capone was treated better. You know, interesting, you know, they got Al Capone on tax evasion, which is basically what they're going to get Manafort on.
Yeah, I don't know how he doesn't, you know. If I was a betting person on this one, he's going to be convicted.
Certainly, and this is to squeeze him to turn and you know, turn on Trump and tell all the meetings and all of the stuff. Because now, evidently, there was a second meeting before the Trump Tower meeting that, you know, you just got to go. You know, the lies eventually will come to light. But here's the thing that caught my attention. You know, you got Manafort, who's kind of like this mob thug character, or so they've painted him. And you've got Gates, who evidently was robbing him blind.
Right. Yeah, correct. Yeah, he siphoned off a couple hundred thousand here and there.
Yeah, what's a couple hundred thousand among friends?
Well, you got enough. You got $60 million from the candidate. So
man. Wow, that's just, I mean, that's money that I can't even imagine what you would do with. And then how you could be broke at the end of it. Like, look, if you're buying a $15,000 ugly ostrich coat, you know, I kind of get maybe I think it was like $1,500 for satin trousers or whatever that is. If you're wasting money on that kind of stuff, maybe, but the numbers they're talking about, I have no idea how you're broke with that kind of
money. Right. Yeah, how could you be?
Which is why the judge is like, you know, we don't want to talk about the wealth too much, because all of those people in the jury, they're probably making 50, 60, 70 grand a year, and to hear somebody pissing that away on something stupid like satin drawers, you know, I would kind of be biased, so I kind of get that.
Sure. Right.
And finally, I'm still waiting to hear from the Tea Party people. Where are my Tea Twizzlers? Evidently, our deficit has grown by 20%.
Oh, well, yeah, a couple of the things, you know, that I noted on that today. Of, you know, the tax, the payment to pay for the tax bill, of course, is kicking in. And some revenues, the Congressional Budget Office will say that there are some revenues that will come in as a result of taxes, you know, and stimulating the economy. But it's at a loss right now for the revenue side. And then, of course, there's still spending. So you combine those two. And, yes, there is definitely an increase in the deficit. And I read an article where the budget director is at odds with the president, because the budget director is like, we have to do something with, you know, this whole problem. And I guess the White House just is like, they don't, you know, they didn't campaign on deficits, I guess.
Nope. Don't worry about the Tea Party people. They've already been silenced. The money that went into organizing them all gone. So they're back to just wearing stupid T-shirts. Like, I would rather be a Russian than a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see those two bozos?
No, I didn't. I saw things at both national conventions. I just wanted to scream on some of them, though.
I'm with you, but still, I mean, I go back to when it started. I really think it got bad during the Kerry election, when all those people were walking around with Purple Heart Band-Aids. I think that's when things really took a nosedive.
That was terrible.
Absolutely. Right. Bob, appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
I remember that, the Purple Heart Band-Aids. And again, one of the more despicable things I think Republicans have done over the years. If you missed any of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with Hour 2. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.